Should be here, Kathleen Doherty. I think we're still planning. A couple of things. I have not heard from Emmanuel Pratt, who was to be the other person presenting stuff on growing power. I mean, he just hasn't answered any of my emails for quite a while. So either something's happened to him, or his way of saying he doesn't, he's changed his mind, is to just not respond to queries. Hi. So next week, our session will revolve around Kathleen's work rather than Kathleen's and Emmanuel's. I sent around yesterday some supplementary reading that will provide some other kinds of context for it. But I think we should treat this as a different kind of session, really focusing on Kathleen's own paper and on the subsequent trip to Growing Power, where there's kind of two things, two sort of tasks for the session, our seminar session. One is to provide a good brainstorming feedback and just discussion of Kathleen's work. So I think treat the supplementary as context reading rather than comment directly on that, although of course anybody can do anything they want. But also let's use the session as a way of trying to hone up some questions we want to raise when we go there. So we can treat this not just as a field trip show and tell on their part, but also we'll have a kind of more focused set of questions. And indeed, Kathleen undoubtedly has new questions that have grown out of the time since you've done it. So we can treat that as kind of preparation for the Saturday trip. I think let's hold off until next week to actually plan the detail, our logistical details of coordination and rides and all that. We just do that next week. A second general announcement, Matt Hancock has confirmed that he will be coming on the 13th of October. We're changing the order at the very end of the kind of reading and discussion part to have the week when we discuss the wealth of networks, Yochi Benkler's book, to be the week that he's here. So we'll actually have that discussion with him. So that's a Haven Center week. That's on the 27th. So the 27th of October, which is a regular Haven Center week, we'll have an evening seminar following his lecture on Wednesday, where we'll also discuss his book. So that'll be, I think, a more productive way for us to use the occasion of his book. And then Matt Hancock's will be on the 13th of October in the afternoon in our regular slot. I asked him if he'd like to stay for dinner afterwards, and he said that would be great. So what I'd like to propose is that we have dinner at my house, everybody who wants to come. I mean, this isn't an additional course requirement, but anybody who would like to come will have it at my house, and then we can decide closer to the time whether we want to make it a potluck or get, Burrique's or some takeout place. I can sort of see how burdened I feel about that, too. And we don't have to decide that. But we'll have dinner at my house on the 13th. Let's say, 6:30 or 7, people can gather after we leave here. And for anybody who wants to come to that.
It will be at 2:30.
That'll be a regular afternoon seminar. Okay. Yeah, 2:30 to 5:30. And then we'll adjourn for an evening for those who would like to come.
Did we have readings for that?
He is going to send stuff. You also directed me to, I think, 4 papers.
Right.
Which I believe I sent the links for that to everybody, for the Matt Hancock. No, I haven't done that. Okay, well, we can squeeze everybody in on the table. Let's today was billed in the syllabus, in addition to discussing the social economy book. It was billed as the first kind of go-around for everybody to talk about their research interests with respect to this class, how the, what sort of general topic area or specific, you know, it depends upon what stage people are of their thinking. I'll take notes on this, and this is to kind of get a preliminary lay of the land in terms of trying to form research groups. The original, there were two impulses, just to remind you, for why I thought research groups would be a good way to go for this class, rather than just ordinary single-person term papers. One is, I think it's a good idea, in general, to do collaborative work in the context of seminars, because an awful lot of additional learning takes place through the collaboration, by being able to have somebody dedicated with equal commitment to discussing each part of the project. So even if in the end a collaborative project involves people writing quite separate pieces as opposed to actually writing a completely integrated joint paper, I think that's a very valuable thing to do. The second thing was, originally there were 22 people signed up for the seminar, and that was just unmanageable from my point of view in terms of the number of projects that would be generated. We've gradually shrunk. This is now sort of an ordinary seminar size, so that imperative is a little less, but still I think we should try. So my proposal then for today, as we begin, each person say what your interests are around the themes. We've already had enough readings and discussion that the broad domain, I think, is getting clearer. What kind of projects you'd want to work on. And it can be more than one. I mean, you can, you know, have a kind of multifaceted possible agenda. And this will then give us some sense of how many clusters there are within the group. Okay? So we can just follow the usual routine of just going around, or anybody wants to. Okay, let's just. But we can just go around, but if you'd rather pass initially, because you'd rather sort of hear how this goes, that's fine too. I don't mind. I don't mean to put you on the spot. Just because clockwise seems to be the standard modality for going around tables, but.
I'm interested in social impact of food cooperatives and also whether investor-owned funds. So, in various ways. I'm so far. I looked at some quantitative measurement to do. It might be a business perspective to do in this, like for example, corporate social responsibility measurement, and also in each organization, they sometimes use social accounting. Mm-hmm. So I'm also interested in that, and might apply to might use a qualitative methodology as well. But that's general interest so far.
So I just want to be sure I've got. So the first thing was about the social impact of food
cooperatives.
So food meaning grocery or food producing?
Grocery.
Grocery, so grocery store, yeah, food store cooperatives. And then you said an investor-owned firms?
Yeah, the general idea is comparing.
Oh, comparing, okay.
Like social impact, like for example, the proportion of the locally grossed food grocery market, for example, and it's very
okay. And so one theme would be a comparison of grocery co-ops,
yeah,
and ordinary grocery stores in terms of their impact on various aspects of.
Yeah, and also I'm not sure whether I can do it, but if it's possible, I want to do some. Producer survey, like a supplier survey.
Mm-hmm.
I have to discuss with other person whether it's possible or not. But yeah.
Okay, supplier survey, a survey of the suppliers to a cooperative.
Cooperative and the other.
Okay.
Investor.
There are some local suppliers here who sell both to Willie Street and to the grocery stores. I think Harmony Valley has
TP.
So that would be a definitely doable, would be to pick, and I'm sure there's others too.
Troy,
so to find a couple of these suppliers and to really see how different is it for, from their point of view to be dealing with a co-op. Yeah, that would be. So this may be part of a food cluster. Survey to cooperative. And then you also mentioned the social accounting and audit kind of issue.
Yeah, there are two approaches. One is corporate social responsibility literature in marketing. They use some comparable measurement, but it's very general. But the other approach is social accounting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to compare firms, but it's more like an individual firm to compare within the firm, within across time, for example.
Okay.
So I want to see both of them and combine and try to make a measurement.
And again, in conjunction with the food cooperative.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm, as I mentioned, I think a little bit in my comments and sending around that social audit. Did anybody have a chance to? I haven't had a moment to look at it. Did anybody look at it? Was it interesting? I mean, I couldn't tell whether it was just a slick, empty report or.
It was a little empty.
My sense is kind of empty as well.
Yeah, because I hear, when I was in Quebec and in other contexts, people talk about social auditing and all this stuff, and it's always strikes me as extremely vague, and I didn't know how they actually do it in a way that gives you something that's useful. So, yeah, I'd be eager for somebody to study that so that we could all find out. Okay. And
I don't have any interest in a specific organization, but broadly, generally, I'm interested in funding of social organization with a very political or transformative goals, and then I wonder how they balance or how they strive in kind of neoliberal economic circumstance. How do they sorry, I'm still very vague.
So no, it's okay to be vague, but we still, so to speak, we want. We need clarity on the vagueness, just so we can have a kind of focus. So you're interested in the funding of social organizations with transformative goals, and how, in particular, how they survive in the neoliberal context. But I think the term funding of social organization, that could include all of these new innovative financial instruments too, mm-hmm. not just things like grants and NGO, foundations, but there are these various things that are being developed in various places for new financial instruments mm-hmm. for social enterprises. Are you interested in that sort of thing as well?
Yes.
So things like solidarity funds, or the Fiducie, which is this new organization, this new financial long-term patient quasi-equity capital, whatever that means. that in Quebec that they've developed.
There's something called slow money here.
Slow money, that's part
US
of the same. Yeah. I think it would be a nice kind of project to have a group around the financing of the social economy. Mm-hmm. Because it's a pretty complicated, there's a lot of technical stuff and it's pretty complicated to really get a kind of full inventory of the existing state of affairs and where the innovative processes are coming from, and then how this intersects things like cooperatives versus other forms of social enterprise. So that could definitely be a good kind of cluster if there's other people interested in that sort of thing. Okay.
So,
Matt.
So there are various ways that social economistically delivering healthcare in the United States and many more outside of the United States. One of the ones in the United States is something called a federally qualified health center. There's about 1,200 such organizations in the country, and they have many of the types of characteristics that we've been interested in. It's an organization that I know a fair bit about. I used to work for such an organization, and I would like to research them. There'd be room in terms of building a group for somebody to look at another type of community health, whether it was a cooperative or whether it was a state-funded thing or whether it was a nonprofit free clinic or whether it was some other form, especially outside or inside the United States. One of the things about federally qualified health centers is that the patients make up the board of directors. Not all of the patients, but the board of directors consist of patients. So they have a cooperative-like quality to them in that respect. And there's some differences. That sort of thing where there's consumer governance could be compared potentially even to a non-healthcare organization in the context of the same paper, depending on what we decided to do. So if people don't want to do healthcare, maybe if somebody wants to do that there's room for that too, I suppose. So I'd like to be really flexible about that, but I kind of had my heart set on doing federally qualified health centers.
Health would certainly be a good interest cluster because there's lots of different things. I know Thailand's been interested in health in various contexts. Whether it be done comparatively internationally would be fine, or across different kinds of organizations would be fine. I think the issue of kind of stakeholder boards is something that may come up in a variety of different papers, and it's one of the themes that at our weekend retreat we can do our own comparisons across things rather than having a research group on that form across topics. Of course, that would be possible as well, but a more natural, because of the what it takes to become really on top of a topic, a more natural way of having clusters is around sectors or types of problems that are being solved, rather than stakeholder boards across all different sorts of sectors. I would think that that would be a tougher kind of project to do in the time available. Okay, so far we have three proto-clusters. Eating, healing, and funding. And I assume is a kind of ex officio advisor to a lot of things, as opposed to you actually wanting to do it.
Well, actually, I think I do.
You do? Well, good.
If that's okay.
What do you mean, if it's okay? Let's vote on how many people would like Anne to do a project.
No, it's more just that, I guess I'm making this commitment, but I do have some problems with time, but I would like to make this commitment because I think it would definitely enrich my participation, plus I can use this for other things. So the thing that I'm interested in, and I guess I could do it within a sector cluster, but I am particularly interested in sort of the role of governance and ideology in, I guess, particularly traditionally excluded groups. Potentially around employment, I guess that's probably, and I say that not necessarily to put it into the worker co-op context, but enterprise that has employment as one of its goals.
Mm-hmm. What in some countries they refer to as employment insertion.
Right, yeah.
As the kind of one of the social missions, which then can be part of a co-op or it can be part of a social enterprise
exactly. In
some other kind of structure.
But I think the issue of those, of the governance of those organizations and the participation of members or employees in that governance in relationship to, you know, their motivation and where does ideology play a role in that?
Okay.
Yeah, I think I've been used to a much more narrow definition of social economy, so now I get like much more options, and I'm still a bit weak about what I want to do. I thought about like doing something about with people, especially youth, on like the edge of society, mm-hmm. like criminals or drugs or something. How the social economic organizations, a different kind of like co-ops, can do something for this kind of young people, like the normal system. I'm from Denmark, I'm used to a really white system that try to do all kind of things, but there's those people there they can't help and they can't handle, and yeah, something in that area.
So just to be clear, so you're interested in focusing on marginalized young people
yeah.
who are involved with drugs or in other ways marginalized.
Yeah.
And then how social economic organizations of one sort or another can deal with those.
And can do something
for
them.
Now, there could be two, I'm just sort of going to ramble
yeah.
in reaction just to get clarity as to what possibilities lie here. So one could approach that from the service delivery point
yeah.
of view. So there's various kinds of social services which can be provided for drug abuse issues, can be provided by the state, can be provided by large organized private and you know concerns like hospitals, or could be provided by social economy type mm-hmm. organizations. So one thing could be on the service delivery side. The other is more in line with what Anne was talking about, the social inclusion side, how to bring people who are in these vulnerable roles into an organization in a more functioning and
yeah, I'm not quite clear about what I want to do, but it was in this direction, like how they can be a part of society again, not especially in the delivering mission.
Did you ever
think?
You may know about it or you may not, but I know someone on campus who's doing research on, I think it's setting up, the idea is worker cooperatives in prisons to reduce mm-hmm. recidivism. So the idea comes from Italy, but there are people in Wisconsin state government who are interested, and so it raises interesting ideas of, so how is this the social economy, or is this just a different type of prison labor? And I'm sure she would be happy to have help on that.
That's it. Is there in Italy there is a form of worker
yeah.
co-op that is internal to prisons? That
I think so. This is Anne White.
Yeah, I thought that that it's more. Returning prisoners. I'm pretty
okay.
sure it's re-entry.
So yeah, maybe
it'd be a really fantastic innovation.
But there are in Wisconsin, there are some innovative things happening in prisons around gardens and things like that. But of course, it's for 10 cents an hour. You know?
Yeah,
right. I'm not entirely clear.
But she is doing. Yeah.
Who's the person?
Anne Hoyt.
Mm-hmm. And what department is she?
She's in hematology.
Is that HOYT?
Yeah.
And you're working with her? Okay, so, I mean,
that's a great thing.
That seems like a possible mm-hmm. set of connections. And I think, Anne and Nina, your interests certainly, you know, connect,
sure.
even if, just in terms of...
There are, it's just so I can throw something in, too. There are progressive health organizations that do outreach in prisons, and they do health education, and they do other types of... facilitating mm-hmm. reentry and facilitating general
knowledge. It's just going to be one
group. Yeah, the social. As far as I know, none of the things that I've read or have seen have as their title social economy in prisons. You know?
What's your name?
Nina. And your last name is Baron?
Yeah.
Yeah.
B-R-R-O-N.
B-A-R-O-N. Okay, Steve. Do you go by Steve or Steven? I forget.
Steve.
Okay.
So I'm interested in truckers and more generally worker co-ops, and one of the possible projects I've thought about is modeling a trucker co-op and what that would look like, and that would be partly based in the research that I've done so far on truckers, in terms of the organization and labor process and markets and the desires of the workers that I've interviewed. But in the interest of spreading myself too thin, I have an interest in the Union Cab Company. I'm sure some of you know a lot more about it than I do. I've just ridden their cabs a couple times. But cabbies and truckers have a lot in common in terms of the variety of employment relationships that you find in each industry, the kinds of resources they need, like dispatchers, and then the ownership of the vehicle. All these issues are similar across these two industries. And in one of my rides, I always interview cabbies whenever I ride in a cab. In my last cab ride, I heard a dissenting voice regarding the addition of some Priuses to the Union Cab Company's fleet. Apparently there's a new green cab company that they see as a significant threat to their market share. And the current leadership has decided to add a number of Priuses. This driver was considering running for the board, I guess, primarily based on opposition to this idea, adding green cabs. And he saw it as sort of as the company spreading, spreading out into goals and agendas that weren't core to the organization. At the same time, he acknowledged that, it was also a market share idea, but he didn't think the economics worked. But it was also, I was gathering, partly about the labor process. He didn't want to drive these little cars. And he didn't want to miss fares that they couldn't fit in these cars. Anyway, that would be something that a company that I would be interested in. I think if others are interested maybe in environment or and labor combinations or sort of mixing together different social goals, values, etc., that would be something I'd be interested in.
Yeah, I mean, as a kind of empirical backdrop to subsequent work on potential cooperatives in trucking, really getting a full handle on the cab company would be obviously a kind of a useful thing. Do you know, are there any cooperative trucking companies, as far as you know?
No, not that I know.
I mean, there may be, but...
there may be some very small ones.
Yeah.
There are some very large ones that are all owner-operator, claim to be almost like a cooperative, except they make a profit for their investors.
They have outside investors as well as owner-operated trucks.
Yeah, they basically just provide the minimal services that the drivers would need, but they they take the full share of the profit gain from the market transactions.
It is a little bit of a puzzle why, if you have owner-operators, then need a cooperative infrastructure for dispatches, for coordination, why they don't do what dairy farmers did. Dairy farmers have dairy co-ops just for that reason, that in order to retain a higher percentage of the total value added from dairy, they create dairy co-ops to process the milk so that the profits aren't all made up higher in the value chain.
Yeah.
And you'd think that wouldn't be such a daunting thing to do, but
my sense is that in these larger companies, the workers almost see their employer or their company in that way. They still feel a sense of ownership, even though they can't benefit from profit or changes in market conditions. But yeah, part of it is likely a result of legacy of federal regulation of the industry, which only allowed for a certain number of companies to exist, and then perhaps antitrust concerns for owner-operators themselves and getting together and
maybe polluting on prices. Maybe physical conditions of driving around the country that don't allow them to form a management.
Isolation.
Trevor.
So I'm interested in this self-employed women's association in India. I really don't have any background in it other than I became interested in it last year. And so a friend and I, we applied for some research money, Shah, who some of you know. And she went there this summer and she did a bunch of interviews over there. So, and a lot of it was related to this question of how cooperatives integrate into the global economy. So that's kind of something that I'm interested in. And so what we were interested in is sort of when a cooperative decides that it's going to really sort of head-on compete with, like, capitalist firms, sort of how does that go and how does that impact the cooperative? So I'm interested in those topics and sort of in terms of a sort of a sector. I like this idea of studying cooperatives in manufacturing and cooperatives specifically in like sophisticated manufacturing, because that would seem to present a lot of challenges as opposed to providing some sort of, or I mean, I don't want to say more or less challenges, but I like the idea of, you know, lots of complex inputs, you know, education is necessary, you know, technology is necessary. So these would seem to present a lot of challenges for the cooperative. So I'm interested in those sort of things.
So those are really two quite, the women's self-employed cooperative is low tech, mainly. It's not.
Well, so they have a big, they do a lot of different things. They're kind of like Mondragon. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they do everything from, we read that case in the Sousa Santos book about, I think, trash collection. But they also do textile manufacturing. And now with this component of the cooperative, they've gone into fashion design. And they're actually now doing fashion shows in New York and European cities. So at least I was interested in that in the textile and garment mm-hmm. component. But they also do things like, salt processing. And so I think they sort of do the range of low to high tech.
And they're called the Self-Employed Women's Association because of the origins of it? Because yep. when you're doing, if they're doing big scale textile manufacturing, they're not hand looms in people's huts.
Right. Interestingly, they have made some efforts to maintain that component. So actually they've developed a value chain where they get the inputs. They have sort of like a centralized... They have sort of a centralized processing center where they receive the inputs, mm-hmm. The fabrics, and they do a lot of the design and the cutting there, and then they send the fabrics out to these villages, to these small places where the finishing and the embroidery of the textiles or the garments gets done, and then it gets sent back.
So that's the part of it that has more of a self-employed character as opposed to this integrative function.
Yes, and one thing I was interested in, I haven't even had the chance to talk to Shah about this, but one thing I was interested in finding out was, as they've shifted into these more sophisticated components, adding this processing center and the center that does the purchasing and designing, are the workers at that center, are they also owners, and are they integrated into the governance of it? And I think the answer is no. I think that it has forced them to sort of compromise the owner-worker character. But it's interesting to me that they've made an explicit attempt to maintain that sort of the local component and sort of these governing bodies.
Mm-hmm. On the high tech side, Madison has one very high tech worker owned cooperative. This
business engineering.
Yeah, that does robotics and and that's a full co-op, right?
It's everybody can be everybody can be a member at any level.
And a very internally egalitarian one, even though there's quite a heterogeneous skill set, because there are there are clerical workers as well as high-end engineers. So, do you know if that's been? Is there a good research study of that?
No, I don't think so.
That's a.
It would definitely, and they are very. They're at a phase where they're very interested in cooperating with researchers.
If somebody is interested in studying cooperatives that really have a kind of cutting edge mm-hmm. in terms of what they produce, I mean, I don't know, organizationally they may be a kind of standard co-op. I don't know how it works.
Oh, they actually, they've got some very innovative governance, very egalitarian from what I can understand.
Yeah.
I would definitely be happy to do a project on something in Madison as opposed to...
Yeah. I mean, let me just say also, just in terms of how we should think about the evolution of our teams and the ideas, I think it's good that when we go around this time, people say what they've already been working on, where their interests are. But part of the opportunity of a seminar like this is to complement what you know best with a new project that would not be on exactly just pursuing what you... So, Trevor, if you're interested in studying this very interesting that happens to be here in Madison, especially if they are interested in being studied,
I could definitely put you in touch with people.
You know, that could certainly be part of a cluster. And what's the name of the company again?
Isthmus Engineering.
Isthmus, okay.
And they do global business, so globalization has affected them.
Okay, Kathleen. Well, we know what you're.
I'm interested in. I mean, I'll just say a couple things. You know, I came upon this kind of, I don't know, 8 years ago or 9 years ago, just this idea that people in the alternative food movement were interested in being perpetually alternative, and that anything that you know, just that notion. So that's kind of what hooked me into the whole study. And as I did more work on exclusion, is really what I was looking at, was, you know, how different aspects of the alternative agri-food movement were exclusive by definition, or some of the things both at the state level, also from a private perspective, and also cooperatives, you know, and also kind of social economy stuff like CSAs, and some of the structural aspects of them. And then also more broadly, looking at, you know, things like labor, you know, and when you look at... farm labor, you know, and saving family farms, or you're not looking at the migrant workers who are working for them. That's not in the discourse that deals with the local food movement. And so, if you look historically, like at least in this country, about how, you know, land has been distributed or been acquired, you know, it's very racially biased, and there's, you know, lots of Supreme Court cases and state court and federal court cases that have dealt with. You know, trying to make amends for racial exclusion. So there are lots of the exclusionary aspects that I was interested in. And then when I came across Growing Power, you know, I was interested in it because I saw it as a hybrid, which I never called it that because I didn't have any of this lingo, you know, when I was doing my work on it. But I was interested in kind of how it situated itself to kind of mediate those critiques, how it attempted to not be exclusive while at the same time you know, being part of the private sector, you know, dealing quite extensively with the private sector, but also with cooperatives and kind of how it brought together a number of different sectors to address, you know, what I saw, you know, as fairly significant exclusion on the parts of a bunch of different organizations involved. So, you know, I'm definitely interested in updating what I've got, what I did, but I'm also interested in looking at, you know, some different organizations, and I've got a fair amount of experience, certainly in this area, with different CSAs, the Delicious Co-op, the Troy Gardens, lots of different organizations that would be good examples of hybrids, but also interested too in just kind of straight private sector work too. So.
And you were on the board of Willie Street.
I have a couple more weeks left of my term. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that would be obviously a good connection for you in terms of.
Yeah.
Having,
I have lots and lots, right, exactly, it's really soon. But yeah, you know, I certainly, as far as something to offer for people, you know, I've been on the board for 3 years, so in terms of their governance structure mm-hmm. and operations and just a whole lot of stuff, I've got lots and lots of detail on that. So.
Emmanuel.
So I think my general interest is really in the process of transformation. And that doesn't mean like transformation at the organization level, but transformation kind of wider sectoral level, so whatever the sector that might be. So how do practices, you know, really change from one kind of like standard to another? So that could be like specifically like located in kind of environmental sector, or maybe also in the food sector. You know, how do certain like ways of producing kind of crowd out other ways of producing, for example? And like, and how resilient are like these new forms of organization, like faced either with a crisis or faced like with opposition from competition, just with like opposing interests? And then I'm quite open about like the kind of sector and like the area, but I'm leaning towards kind of like the environmental sector. It doesn't necessarily have to be food, but like, I haven't looked into it like.
So in a way, I mean, those particular interests could, as you say, apply to almost any of the areas. So one way of thinking about how you'll connect with a group is we can form some clusters around some of these themes, and then you could join one of those with your perspective on it being this issue of how practices become innovative and then generalized and reproduced in the face of shocks and crises and, you know, and so on. So, I mean, an example is in Union Cab, as they face this competition from a green cab company and they're trying to deal with how are we going to relate to the environment, which is outside of our original mission, which was just an ordinary worker co-op.
Yeah.
That, if there was a group that was going to study Union Cab, you could be particularly looking at that nexus of.
I mean, and having said that, this is kind of embedded in a wider interest in like environmental crisis and then kind of these kind of more sustainable reactions to it. So my interest leans towards the environmental, but you're right. I mean, it is kind of applicable to like many sectors.
So I'm interested in food as a sort of substantive area generally, but I'm also interested. I'm interested in sort of institutional and legal innovations or attempted innovation to get capital to alternative food institutions. Which that could be, I mean, financial capital or human capital, trying to get cheap labor that's, you know, not forbidden by immigration law to this sort of thing, because often the alternatives tend to be labor intensive rather than capital intensive types of agriculture. So that's sort of one area. I've also become interested recently in different types of business forms that are more attempts to get financial capital to social economy feeling organizations, like the low profit limited liability company concept, which is spreading from state to state and isn't in Wisconsin yet, and a new type of cooperative that was created in Wisconsin law a few years ago, which allows there to be non-patron members who are investors and who may or may not vote. And both of which feel like ways to get more money into companies that are trying to do good and maybe make a profit.
So yeah, so that funding focus has come up at least.
Oh, and then there's one particular thing that's going on in Madison which I'm interested in, which is the growing power sort of place on the south side of Madison. Mm-hmm. They've got a project going, which I think is called Resiliency Center or something like
Badger.
That. Yeah.
Center for Resiliency.
So they've just started planting, I think, this season. But I think that they've probably done a lot of the sort of institutional forum discussions already, and maybe still working that stuff out, which would be interesting to me to talk to them. I'm also interested in what Growing Power is doing in Milwaukee and Chicago.
I mean, that would be an extremely valuable thing to do right now. If they are an organization in formation that's done the first phase of its development, to intensively study that phase of it so that you really have in real time that data with interviews about obstacles, dilemmas, the choice points they made, all those kinds of things, to have that understood now, then, you know, you or others can study its development over the next several years.
I think, though, I haven't confirmed it with him, that Mike Bell is like the director of sociological studies of this place. But I'm not, you know, I want to talk to him about exactly what he's doing, if anything, on that. So it's sort of maybe fit with other stuff that he's
and
doing.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I mean, in the growing power context, there is this stuff in Chicago, there's the Milwaukee and there's Madison. Those are three very different kinds of cities.
Okay.
You know, to look at, and this might be one aspect of the way Kathleen might want to kind of extend some of the work you've done, to see what that kind of initiative, the problems it faces under these different urban contexts.
I could also add that there's a new co-op that I've been working with that just got a large USDA grant to help its formation, called Spring Rose Growers Co-op, mm-hmm. out in Verona, and it's made up of people from Thailand and Laos and Mexico and Colombia, so it's a socially disadvantaged farmer group, and it would be along the same lines of studying formation, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, there definitely seems to be a foodie cluster. I hope that is a, as they say, you know, sociological research, an unobtrusive indicator of the quality of any potlucks we might have at the workshop at the end of the semester, when we go off into Upham Woods. The Saturday night meal is a potluck. That is, people have to bring stuff, and we have camp stoves to heat things up, rather than rely on the adequate but not very interesting conference center food for the evening meal. So, you know, if there's this much interesting agriculture and food, my expectations are raised to a very high level here. Just to, okay, Lindsay.
I'm interested in two things, and it doesn't really matter whether it's food or healing or whatnot, but. First thing I was interested in is how does the size of the working class in a place, and how does like effort of working class organizations in a place like affect, or does it affect at all, like the organization of social economy organizations, and does it do that through like people's individual consciousness or through the kind of institutional arrangements that they've fought for? So that was kind of one question.
So again, you said, how does the size?
Like the size of the working class in general, but then also like how does like the effort of working class organizations like unions affect?
By size, you mean, I don't know what size of the working class means. You mean it's percentage?
I was thinking mostly in terms of like different places, in terms of how big the informal sector is, because in the informal sector a lot of people are self-employed because they're unemployed, versus having a place where there isn't a very large informal sector.
Okay.
And then like the other thing I was interested in is just reading a lot about how social economy organizations, they experiment and they kind of decide where they go based on where they've been. I was thinking about this book, I don't know if anyone's read it, but it's The Economy of Cities by Jane Jacobs, and she talks about the creation of new work, and in a capitalist economy, a lot of new work is created through breakaways, that people have this position in a firm, and like they create new work based on like the function of their position or the content of the position, and they go start their own firm. And I was just thinking, how do breakaways work? Like, is it more or less conducive in a social economy? Because like maybe there's less focus on market share, but maybe there's more focus on efficiency. Because like when you have breakaways, that's really inefficient. And then they have different sources of financing, so maybe that would also affect creation of new work based on old work.
What is breakaway?
It's when somebody is in a firm and they're they have like they're they're in this like, they have one area within this bigger division of labor, but then they take something from their position within this division of labor, whether it's based on, like, let me think. For instance, like in 3M, like it's a company in Minnesota, there's this, there are these guys that were working in a, for like a mining company, and they were sifting different kinds of salts, but then they decided, oh, we're going to, you know, attach this salt to tape, and then they started their own company by doing that.
I don't quite see how that, what's the social economy question with respect to that?
Well, is it common
what it would,
for
what
like
it would mean to stud, to actually have a study of that in the social
is there economy? Is like there an analogous, you know, people break away when they have innovation? Or?
Yeah, if you want to, if you're doing something in a social economy organization, how easy is it, or like, is it analogous to like just a regular firm? How easy is it to just break away and start your own organization?
I'm not sure how you'd study that. I mean, that is
life cycle? Is it life cycle of organization?
There's another question of like emergence of the social.
Yeah.
clusters, sort of?
Well, oh, or these groups that end up forming lots of different organizations, like what you read about.
Is there
start out as a housing co-op and then end up going into food.
One thought also is, if we're talking about the same thing, like breakaway happens when somebody feels that there's sort of like an unmet market need, so there might be some sort of aspects for specialization, which might relate to sort of like development of a sector, or sort of like increasing complexity. If there's a particular employee that has a special skill set, a special set of knowledge, and then they would sort of move off and start their own business based on that.
I mean, there's the general question of how social economy or social enterprises, if we want to use that rubric, how they get started, and undoubtedly some take the form of spin-offs from existing organizations, and others are just started by a group of people who come together to start something. But I don't immediately see what would be a distinctive social economy problem with respect to that. You know, people start organizations in all sorts of ways. Yeah, Nate.
Maybe the role of ideology in somebody deciding to break away. I'm thinking of, it may not be social economy enterprise in the sense of production, but there was a breakaway from Greenpeace a while ago when one of the founders decided that he wanted to actually become a pirate and go ram whaling boats, and there was an ideological split, and he said, you know, there's unmet need for intervening in the production of whale meat, and I'm going to go buy a boat and do that and form my own organization.
Well, I was thinking of it more in terms of like product markets, because social economy organizations are in product markets that they don't have a lot of competition from capitalist firms. And I was also thinking in terms of funding, because the tendency is when you get state funding, you're less able to be innovative, because you have all sorts of restrictions put on you, at least like around here, I've noticed. And you have all these like lines of accountability, and you have to follow this plan, which would make it difficult for people to be coming and going all the time.
So that seems like a distinctive theme for that could intersect a variety of things. That is, how does the nature of the funding affect the flexibility and capacity for innovation in a social economy?
I mean, that would be really interesting in the health context, for instance.
So that, you know, there's a variety of different types of funding, and some have lots of strings attached, some don't. Some have the character of these angels, you know, that just give you a block grant, and others require lots of monitoring. So one could examine either how organizations make those choices, how aware are they of the trade-offs, but also one could compare a couple of similar organizations but which have different funding. I know it's one of there's a, in Milwaukee, there's another organization that has, you know, some of the same aspects of Growing Power in the sense of its social base, the Walnut Street, you know, which does various neighborhood things. What is it? Is it Walnut Street?
Walnut Way.
Yeah. But they get money from the Bradley Foundation. One of their big funders. Bradley Foundation is an ultra right wing, really nasty foundation.
It's not their only source.
What?
I mean,
it's not their only source.
Right.
So it's hard for me not to feel, maybe unjustly, that anybody, I don't want to have anything to do with anybody who gets money from the Bradley Foundation. I mean, I just find that dirty money. It's like getting money from the CIA or something. I mean, they are, that may be totally, I'm not defending this prejudice on my part. I'm just describing how I feel.
But the interesting thing is, what effect does that have?
But then
on
the
Walnut,
question
right?
is, what does it have? I mean, when I went to the Earth Day celebration at Growing Power, and they had all their corporate sponsors there, it was, to me that was kind of creepy. I mean, I kind of winced when these. I think BP might, was it Shell or might have been BP. I don't know, some something like that. You know, they were all smiling and benevolent and how wonderful this was, and, you know. But on the other hand, money is money, and so it may not have strings attached, and so you may decide who's co-opting whom. Are these big, powerful corporations actually co-opting a social movement, or is the social movement just very cleverly knowing how to pull the strings and get the cash? I mean, so there's a lot of ambiguities around this. That seems to me a clearer agenda than the quote breakaway thing per se. I mean, of course, the funding might play into that.
Yeah, but I was thinking when she said about how funding impacts innovation, and I just by thinking I don't see how you could actually see how
if it's tied to certain requirements in terms of like how you organize the organization, I think it would.
So there are so many factors that can impact innovation that just saying that there is one block might not explain.
So you might, so this raises, this might be a good occasion just to make a little methodological point. If we adopt the standards of high-end, you know, sort of scientific sociology as to what does it take to establish the credibility of an argument, right? Then undoubtedly it's not going to be possible to find the right cases which vary in the right ways around their sources of funding that we can say, yes, when this organization made the decision to adopt this kind of funding, suddenly its innovation rate declined by 72%, right? So that we could make a credible claim to a skeptic that the funding source significantly hampered their innovation. So it's extremely unlikely that that anybody could get evidence that could robustly, in that sense, demonstrate that. So what can you do? Well, you can study how the actors think about the consequences of different funding choices. You could ask them after they make a change or living under a different funding regime, to what extent do they find the monitoring requirements a burden, and how do they think of the monitoring requirements with respect to things they might want to try? So you can get evidence that organizations which don't get funding from the Bradley Foundation, so to speak, feel much freer to do things which are not very respectable, whereas the organizations that do are much more cautious. What you don't know is how much that's self-selection, that is, it's the cautious organizations that are going to get the money. So it's like, this is similar to the following. We know that congressmen who get lots of money from the National Rifle Association vote against all gun control. Mm-hmm. That doesn't show that the National Rifle Association changes anybody's votes, because it's the politicians who, you know, have those views that are going to get the money. So you know, you can't infer a causal impact from the fact of the funding, but you can still, you can study around that theme. That idea could therefore animate the project. That is, you could say, the reason I'm studying the funding and innovation is because I do think different sources of funding either open up or close off innovation. You know you're not going to be able to fully sort that out, but then you can gather evidence around the theme, which then can lead you to have new insights or not, depending upon what puzzles you encounter.
Could I just, because we've been talking about funding, and does funding include self-funded, you know, I mean revenue producing, because that then introduces another mm-hmm. aspect here
yeah.
that would be really interesting. Most market-driven mm-hmm. cooperatives are mm-hmm. totally self-funded. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, though a lot
not
of...
Not to say that that, you know, means they're innovative, but I guess it's
And then there's the Herb Kohl problem. You know, I'm nobody's senator but yours because he funds his entire campaigns without contributions.
That's right. So not to say that, but it is important.
But he should say, I'm nobody's senator but mine. Yes, Stephen.
Yeah, I'm not sure if by innovation you mean like technical innovation.
Yeah,
is
innovation is a whole loaded word.
Yeah, but it does seem that there's a similar question in social movements literature about, you know, funding of NGOs and formalization of NGOs and their ability to employ diverse tactics and strategies and are pushed towards a, you know, certain relationship with the state rather than a broader set of strategies. So, I mean, that might be one way to think about a way to model yeah. the methodology of, you know, selected cases.
Yeah, I mean that would have an interface with that social movement literature about. Okay. So, but just to get back to our theme about the formation of clusters, as it were, Lindsay, your agenda would be one that could be connected to one of these more thematic mm-hmm. clusters, as opposed to it being a standalone
yeah.
cluster. Yeah. The first of the things you mentioned. About working class organizations, I think that's another kind of issue that might become central depending upon how groups evolve, you know, in this. That is, there are long-standing organizations of various sorts, unions being a very good example, but there's also there's other kinds of organizations in the environment of social economy initiatives. And those other organizations can either facilitate or impede them, depending upon the circumstance. So unions have often been quite hostile to cooperatives, and have worked against them in various ways. Whereas in other contexts, they may be quite supportive. They can see it as a complement rather than as a competitor to unions. Tylan.
I think that's a good segue to what I'm interested in. Well, yeah, my first interest is related to what sorts of work environments social economy organizations or social economy in general offers. I mean, first of all, sometimes in some occasions we can see that they offer a different form of labor than wage labor, I mean, which is commonly agreed by the neoclassical economics or Marxists as well, how the capital society work on. But at the same time that, I mean, with different motivations, with different goods or different goals shared by the people, but at the same time they can be more exploitative in the sense that creation of correction centers or, I don't know, someone mentioned prisons, or creation of vocational training programs, which, I mean, I have few examples regarding textile sector from Turkey, from Europe, in my mind, in my baggage. But this sounds really, I mean, I don't know, in a project which is due from 3 months from now, I don't know how this is manageable in a sense. I mean, I might need some feedback from all of you or partner up with someone or group up with someone to work on this. My second interest is more related to the healthcare issue. Well, while I was reading starting from the first week, I always questioned the people refer for instance, there was one article we read about the, who described the John Hopkins, and the, it was, they were talking about healthcare education as social services. For instance, I mean, I question what sort of social services they talk about, despite healthcare and education. Second of all, how is this healthcare issue within the social economy sphere is achievable? I mean, United States spends 16% of GDP on healthcare, but there are still 50 million people who have no access to healthcare. So it's been, I mean, in a sector which is having problems in terms of governance, in terms of funding. At the same time, there's a huge market of healthcare, right, standing next to each other. How is that possible? So, providing healthcare services as a social economy organization. But I have a sort of an, I mean, quasi answer to this. It's protective healthcare, which is very cheap, and which is the most problem of throughout people have no access to protective healthcare, primary healthcare.
You mean preventative or?
Preventative. I mean, all the money goes to the, I mean, through the 90-10 rule. American healthcare system is very treatment or curative rather than being protective. So, and yeah, that's a good area in social economy, could really work, could really help people, and could really raise some sort of level of life among people. Because in this country, I mean, not in this country, you know, you all know the healthcare life expectancy changes district by district. So, and social economy is, seems to me a very good, it might be a really good source of achieving these really basic and really cheap, doable goal of providing protective, preventative healthcare to people. But as a third thing is, I'm also game with just do something without any of my interests, just because of its presence in medicine or Wisconsin too.
So, both of these interests though can be combined, I think, with other things that have been mentioned. So there is a possible healthcare cluster, and you could look at the preventive aspects of the healthcare provision in the kinds of clinics that Matt was talking about.
It's all preventive. Mm-hmm. I assume that they're all preventive.
So there could be, we could look at the same clinics, or we could look at a similar set of clinics that also focus on preventive health. Mm-hmm.
Or you could, I mean, a possible thing that one might do is to look at this kind of clinic and in a context, in the American context, where it's a small niche within a sea of bureaucratic and highly marketized healthcare versus the comparable kind of on the ground base, more cooperative clinics in a place like Quebec, which is operating in a very different environment, but those primary clinics are probably doing much the same sort of thing. So there'd be a lot of possibilities. The other thing, though, with your labor process and work issues, if, for example, a study of union cab was one of the things being done, there's also conventional cab companies in Madison, and comparing the different kinds of labor processes and the way in which how much of a difference in the lives of people it makes, I mean, that could also be part of, you know, you could plug into one of the other projects in that way, on that theme. But I like, in the effort to form research groups, having a few flexible people who basically say, yes, I could join any of these things because I've got, oh, that's always helpful. As
yeah, if the standalone people, you can just...
to give you a, since you are from Turkey, you won't know this baseball metaphor that gets used in this context. So the American guys will, there's this baseball position that's called the utility infielder, right? So a utility infielder is somebody who can play a lot of different positions. They're not a specialist, you know. The pitcher can only pitch. The catcher can only catch. But a utility infielder can play shortstop, second base, third base. Okay, see? And yeah, utility.
What does the name come from?
every team needs a utility infielder, because otherwise you have this kind of rigid structure, and if one person stubs their toe, you're screwed.
Can I make a pitch for the Union Cab Company that I think I was taking for granted until you mentioned it? But what I like about the Union Cab Company or something like that is you can do this comparison, you know, the same market. You know, you could even look at issues of efficiency, right? Or, you know, the advantages, disadvantages of certain democratic or less democratic management structures on dealing with common, you know, similar problems that these cab companies experience. There's also, with this comparison, the potential of this, I don't know much about this green cab company, but it might be a co-optation, perhaps, of this social, you know, value capitalism, you know, or social economy style marketing, right, by a capitalist firm. So there might be some.
I haven't even heard of that. Has anybody else heard of it?
I've heard about it from the Union Cab people, but I think it's just a couple cars. I mean, I think at this point, it's really small.
But yeah, to be a cab company, it has to be licensed by the city, right?
Yeah.
So it's got official standards.
Must have. Mm-hmm. Or it's in the planning stage.
Yeah. Okay. Michael.
Yeah. Okay, so over the summer, I spent some time poking around in Venezuela, specifically around the cooperatives movement there, and also later on something that's called the Socialist Guyana Plan. The name isn't terribly important. What was interesting about it, what was interesting about both of those things to me was the relationship between alternative forms of firm ownership and management and the state. And so the cooperatives movement provided an interesting avenue, and this other thing provides a completely different one, wherein these are companies in what's called the Guyana Corporation, which is a set of capital-intensive, mostly mining and extraction, but also steel production, aluminum production facilities, which were several companies within had movements, workers' movements within them to be. To try to force nationalization, in other words, to make a demand that they be nationalized. And then just in the past year or so, there has been plans to implement forms of workers' management, like have a workers' management state-owned scheme. And I'm interested in this sort of thing because it kind of gives an interesting perspective on the relationship between kind of non-traditional firm governance schemes and the state, and also because this is a way to approach very high high capital intensity firms, which usually are sort of obstinate when it comes to kind of cooperative governance. It's very difficult. It's really quite unusual for firms of this type to be governed under cooperative structures, the notable exceptions being Mondragon and a few others. So that's something, the broad theme there is relationship to the state and politics. And I'm also interested in, related to what a couple of other people have said, relations to the labor movement more broadly, specifically unions, which Venezuela also provides an interesting case, but I'm interested in these sorts of themes, not in a specifically Venezuelan context, but more generally. But I do probably know most about the Venezuelan context. And finally, I guess I'm interested in something related to Thailand's first of three proposals, which has to do with kind of the employment relationships within social economic firms, and sort of internal governance, and sort of tying into a discussion to use Eric's terminology, what's corrosive and what's reproductive of capitalism, and so trying to situate social economic firms in this kind of a discussion, where you talk about what kinds of firms even if they're squarely within the social economy, reproduce capitalist relations, and how come? And to what extent they don't, why not, and what's going on there? And also, I mean, that has to do with, I sent an email to the class about, you know, relationships to labor markets and stuff like this, and this question is also related. So I'm broadly interested in the corrosive versus reproductive aspect. So I guess those are my three topics. Also, the engineering firm, the Isthmus Engineering, does sound quite interesting. And I'm also a little bit flexible in that.
I mean, that's a thing that you could certainly take some of these
in terms of capital intensity. Yeah, is directly related. Yeah,
you know, it's small as opposed to a steel factory or an auto factory. So it's not just capital intensity that's in play; it's also scale. So
sure.
Some of the things which you raised are kind of big themes, not so much term papers, as it were. So,
right.
You know, corrosive or not of capitalism, that's kind of a perspective to bring to bear on a study rather than a topic exactly.
Yeah.
So that's one that could easily connect to a number of the other kinds of projects that have been done. One issue would be, there's been a couple of suggestions for projects that are not U.S.-based or Madison-based, so to speak. The India Self-Employed Women's, the Venezuelan Cooperatives, or this other hybrid state-owned, worker-managed type firm in Venezuela. So it is possible that a cluster could form around the social economy in developing context, where you'd have different experiences that would be somehow brought into alignment with each other. One issue there is the extent to which one can really do a good, rigorous term paper of an original sort on that from Madison in the context that we have, or whether honing your research skills and your ideas around those things by picking a topic that you can actually do hands-on stuff here still might be a better. So doing the Isthmus Engineering could be a better focus, even if your basic interests are the ones you described in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sure.
So you were talking about the state, the relation of the state to sort of this capital-intensive industry, and that's also something that very much interests me about the Indian case, as well as the role that the state has had in supporting or obstructing the emergence of the Self-Employed Women's Association. Another thought that I had is that to make this project kind of more doable, maybe what we could do is we could look at what a large capital intensive cooperative looks like 20 years down the road in the United States. When we look at one of the big cooperatives that has kind of grown to the point where it's lost a lot of its cooperative characteristics, because I just remember reading about like Lando Lakes and some of these bigger like dairy cooperatives that have kind of integrated, and then ultimately comparing those.
Now those, of course, are this special kind of cooperative where the constituent units are private firms. Land of Lakes is a processing cooperative. I mean, it's a dairy cooperative, but the farmers are all private. So it's not that it isn't a cooperative as a result, but it's quite different from a worker cooperative. Because the employees of Land of Lakes are not, they're just employees. They're not owner members of. There's also, just as a little point, there is this difficult problem in studying the life cycle of an organization, because it occurs in real history, not just. So if it were the case that organizations were like people, so that you can say, studying an 80-year-old, you're learning a lot about the biological, the maturation and decline of over the life cycle, whether you're studying that 80-year-old now or 100 years ago, so there's some contextual effects, but still basically the genetic structure that determines the course of growth and then decline is sufficiently context independent that you can still learn a lot about the general properties of aging, regardless of where you study it. But that isn't true for something like a co-op. So a co-op that starts in the U.S. in the year 1990, looked at in the year 2010, has experienced a very different set of pressures from a co-op that was started in 1950, looked at in 1970. And so the context really impinges. That's an interesting, if not very rigorous, discussion in the first chapter of today's reading. Amin was making this point about you can't put everything in the context. The individual characteristics of a firm do matter. But in the end, most of the action does seem to be in the stuff that they were talking about, in the context. But these are, of course, these are themes that can get grappled with in these projects. Okay, we have two more. I think what we should do is have two more and then take a break and just let this mull. I'll type up these notes. They'll be incomplete. I didn't take super careful notes, but I'll just circulate to everybody these scattered notes so you'll have them afterwards. So, okay. Mm-hmm. Aicha.
First of all, I really don't have a specific sector or organization interest. I'm more interested in the theoretical issue, which can be, of course, a burden, because some of the questions that I had in mind were very similar to what Michael already said, the transformative aspect of it. But of course, for a term paper that and such a short period of time, I see that the question also has to be well phrased. So in that case, I think there are two things I particularly would be interested in looking at. It would be, first of all, internal governance, especially in organizations which we can call hybrids. So, for example, like marketing cooperatives that also employ, full-time or part-time employees. So how do these people, what is the relationship between these people and basically the members of the cooperative? So which really ties to the ideology aspect of it. So how do these people understand their role and what they're doing? And so, for example, what is the role of experts is also another important thing, because that's another power dimension which might be relevant to the this high-tech organization we were talking about. And secondly, it's related to the constraints and dilemmas an organization, a social economy organization faces, such as like efficiency problems or cost problems. And in those cases, again, the issue turns out to be some kind of a trade-off between ethical commitments and survival, and where the organization goes, which in a way, in fact, links to, in one way, employing, for example, people, for example, marketing cooperatives, they're just, working for a wage. That could be one option. So for now, that seems to be.
Mm-hmm. So these are, sort of all three of the things you said, the broad transformative issue, the internal governance question, especially in the context of hybrids,
yes,
and the constraints and dilemmas that
yes.
face. These could be strong thematic cores connected to any of these mm-hmm. particular projects.
Yes.
So, one way of envisioning forming a team is that there's a couple of people who are really knowledgeable about the substance of a particular sector, like food co-ops or healthcare,
mm-hmm.
and other people who are eager to learn about the sector, because you can't answer these questions without
exactly.
actually getting to learn mm-hmm. about it. But in which so you would be fully participating in whatever observational and data gathering stuff the team needs, but that you would be particularly focused then in your contribution and in your thinking and then in writing the thing up on the internal governance
yes.
issues connected to that, or the ethical dilemmas connected to it.
Mm-hmm.
When, by the way, just as a another point. I don't know if I haven't said this explicitly. When students do collaborative projects in seminars, first of all, my working assumption in graduate seminars is that everybody gets an A, so there's no grading issue in a graduate seminar. You have to really be obnoxious and not do work, and just, you have to really go out of your way. If you don't want an A, you got to really work at it. Okay, I think grading is bullshit at this level. That's not the point. So, and the reason I say that is, therefore, it's unimportant whether there are identifiable sections that are written by particular people. You know, this is a collaborative project. Collaborative projects work in all sorts of different ways. Sometimes it's a first draft and then other people fill in the gaps and then they do revisions. Sometimes there are well-defined sections that different people write and then they rewrite each other's sections. There's just all sorts of different ways to do it. That's part of what you have to discover, is how do you best collaborate? How do you work on this? And I can give plenty of advice on that. I can help you figure it out, but there's no instructions on that. So it doesn't have to be the case that when you form a team, you figure out, okay, you're going to do part one, you're going to do part two. No, I mean, that's one way of doing it, but. Okay? João.
Okay, so what I'm interested in working on is the relation between cultural identity and social economy, and specifically how culture and identity, they might complexify what we talk about hybrid, so and especially the dynamics between market, state, and social economy when they are embedded in culture. And I'm also interested in how culture and identity might impact transformation, and how in that sense cultural identity might lead to specific dilemmas in talking in social economy toward transformation. I'm specifically, again, interested in studying social economy initiative by a Native American population in the United States, and I've talked to Anne about fighting a case that would be interesting, and we are sort of working about fighting it, but apparently we might have one that is in the Menominee Nation. There is a social economy initiative around forestry. So in that case, in my sense, if it's actual social economy case, and we are not sure about that, would be really interesting because of, among other teams, the specific experience of capitalism by Native Americans, their sense of community, and also their understanding of environmental issues. So that's basically. So I don't know in which sector.
Yeah, that's a different. This is, the general issue of culture and identity, as it's deployed within social economy enterprises, that can be applied in a non-indigenous. The word culture can mean the culture of truckers. So I know one of the themes in Steve's dissertation is there's this kind of very individualistic culture among these truckers, and how that affects the way they create self-delusions in a way about being your own boss. You know, so the be your own boss theme in American culture is very strong, even though independent truckers do worse than the truckers who don't, with more miserable existences and so on. So I mean, that's a cultural theme as it would intersect various things. But if you're specifically interested in the, you know, cultural clash and the kind of indigenous versus Western, or pre-capitalist versus capitalist, and that kind of issue, that wouldn't fit into as projects as smoothly as some of the other things. What's this Menominee initiative? I mean,
I think I my understanding is they have a very long-standing forestry management and wood product enterprise, and it's one of the largest contiguous forests in Wisconsin. So it's a very sustainable, very different methodology than is used in the rest of the state for forestry management. And I think the thing that I'm not sure of is that whether it's 100% tribal run, in which case it's a state enterprise, and then that might take it out of the social economy. You might have to dive down into that, but I've got a couple people that I'm trying to contact to for contacts within that. But it's a, I mean, it's got a lengthy history. So.
I actually worked in sustainable forestry stuff before I came to graduate school. So I
here?
No, but well, nationally right. In the U.S. and then yeah. In Canada. So and with First Nations in British mm-hmm. Columbia,
right, right.
Developing cooperative, you know, and then the Forest Stewardship Council, familiar with that, mm-hmm. Developing the marketing for that actually.
Yeah, and I have contacts in that sort of world too. So it's just, yeah, so. But there would be definitely interesting governance issues in that. I mean, there's always interesting governance, I get the feeling, in the Indian country, so.
Okay, look, we've spent an hour and a half on this. I mean, that's all right that we have this. I think it was important for everybody to hear everybody and to mull. What I will do is send this around, and here's how I think, here's a kind of process thing. Of course, you all can talk to each other. Everybody has everybody's emails. Anyone who wants to write up short memos about in reaction to this list of themes and what you've heard today, which are can be in the form of some ideas about possible projects that you'd be interested in forming a group around. Now, not everybody has to write those, but I think the way a cluster gets formed is somebody taking kind of initiative. I'm declaring I'd like to form a cluster. Let's see who else can join. And start sending those memos. I think the way to do it, you can either just, everybody could send them around to the whole list, or you could send them to me and I'll send them around so that they all, not that I'll censor them or anything, but that, you know, then I can keep good track. Does the distribution list work for everybody? Can everybody use the class distribution list?
Is it on your Learn at UW?
It's not, I haven't set this up on Learn at UW.
Is it somewhere else?
It's just, when I send a message to all of you, there is a, it says SOCH929-F10 or something.
Yeah.
Can anybody in the class can use that?
If they're registered with the correct email.
Yeah, I've put everybody on the list, and everybody's getting these things, right?
Yeah.
So that we can.
So then, okay, so then, because then I get it.
Or you can, I mean, you can add the non-students
yeah,
as
I've
guests.
Yeah, I've added guests of the people. So.
And they can use it.
Okay, well then I think, then I don't think there's a need for this to first go to me and then get sent around. So I will send this around later today. You'll all get this memo with these kind of fragmentary notes. And then we should just start writing short memos and proposals and ideas over the next 10 days or so, and see how this gels, kind of inductively. And then I'll also write reactions and suggestions and so on. And then 2 weeks from now, which will be the session after the Growing Power field trip, we'll try to actually consolidate research groups. Okay. All right, so let's take a 10-minute break since we've been going for an hour and a half. We can meet at a quarter after, and then we can discuss the Amin book.